Ladies and gentlemen, my name is David Berto. I don't merit a name tag, and so I have to introduce myself here, but I don't quite know where you'd put a name tag anyway. On behalf of Dr. John Hamry, I want to welcome you all to this latest in our series of military strategy fora on QDR and QDR issues, obviously a very timely series of events. Our objective at CSIS is to provide a forum for discussion of critical issues in a timely and unbiased and nonpartisan manner. Dr. Hamry is fond of saying that there's no such thing as nonpartisan because everything has politics in it, but we do our best nonetheless. So I want to thank you all for coming. I want you to introduce our distinguished speaker this morning, the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Gary Ruffhead. He's had a very distinguished Navy career, and he actually brings what I think is a unique global view based on his background and experience to the challenges that we face today. He has commanded fleets in both the Pacific and the Atlantic, which is highly unusual, as you know. He also has had some unique experience in Washington. He has this habit of doing his Pentagon tours at a time of presidential transition. He was here in the transition from Reagan to Bush, and those of you who survived that know that just because it's inside the same party doesn't mean that that it's less bloody. The blood is just spread out over a longer period of time, and so it doesn't seem that way at the front end. And he came back in time of the Rumsfeld transition in 2001 and was here as the Chief of Legislative Affairs on 9/11, which is, of course, another set of unique challenges. So please join me in welcoming the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Gary Ruffhead.
Well, thanks. It's great to be here and to see so many familiar faces, colleagues and shipmates from over the years. And it is true that I do pick my returns to Washington on 10-year centers, to use a shipbuilding term. But it has been great to be back. It's been about a year and a half since I relieved Mike Mullen as Chief of Naval Operations, and the time has flown by. In fact, I'll get some feedback from you on what Washington is like, because for the last month or so, I've been out and about, made the first visit by U.S. Chief of Naval Operations to South Africa, which was a very worthwhile trip and opportunity to reconnect with my counterpart, who I've had the pleasure of working with for the past year and a half. Hosted the first Sea Lord, my UK counterpart here, the weekend after that, and then the weekend after that, went to China for my fourth visit and my third time with my counterpart, Admiral Wu Shengli, to participate in their 60th anniversary of the founding of the PLA Navy, which was a very worthwhile trip and one that I believe is important as we move forward with our relationship with China. So it has been busy. That spurt of travel came after a period of time of staying pretty close to the tent here in D.C. as we worked our 2010 budget. My philosophy is when they're working on your budget, you don't go far from home because others will work it for you if you're not there. And so with that said, I found the process. And I know there's been some things written about it, but I found the process to be very fair, very open, very high level of professional discussions that allowed us to address the very substantive things that one would expect the department and the leaders of the services to be engaged in. I can't say enough about the leadership, the involvement, and the support of Secretary Gates. The time that he spent in the budget discussions, in the lead up to the budget discussions, and in availing himself to those of us who were involved in those discussions, to me, as has been said from my touch and goes in Washington, I found his involvement and his leadership to be extraordinary in that regard. We made some decisions based on capabilities that I think, as a person who comes from the fleet, were exactly the way that we needed to come at the problem. And I would say that what we did reaffirms the direction that I had set for the Navy when I came in to this office. But now we're at a time where I believe it is very important that we meet these important decisions and challenges head on. What we have been able to do in the Navy over the last year and a half, I think, has fundamentally set the course for our future. Shortly after coming in and with Secretary Don Winter, made the decision to terminate two ships, Littoral Combat Ships 3 and 4, because, in my judgment, the costs of those ships were out of control. And if we did not get those costs under control, I was concerned for the future of that class, which I consider to be extraordinarily important to the future of the Navy and the nation, and that I predict, when it is all said and done, they will be the workhorses of the fleet, and the LCS will have 1,000 fathers. And so we did that, and we now have a third LCS under contract. The first one is in commission and operating, and I would encourage any of you who would like to see it to head down to Alexandria next week, where Freedom will be moored as part of our Sea Air Space Symposium that Steve Petropoli here will gladly arrange for any free passes to anyone that wants to go. We then moved on and made the push to truncate the DDG 1000, a ship that has been in development since the early 90s, a program that I would add is extraordinarily well managed. It contains some incredible technology that will be important to the fleet. But as I looked at the DDG 1000, its combat capabilities were not what we need today and not what I envision us needing in the future. And we made the move to restart the DDG 51 line because it is in the area of air and missile defense, integrated air and missile defense, and blue water ASW that I am most pressed with regard to providing those capabilities to our Navy component commanders and to the combatant commanders. We've also canceled some programs because they were non-performing. The multi-role underwater unmanned vehicle canceled that, and then a weapons program, Harpoon 3, that was not performing, and we canceled that. So my point in all of these is there has to be some tough decisions that are made, and it is based on what combat capability we need and the performance of the program, and that's where we're headed. But we've also done some other things to address the needs of the Navy of the future. We have stood up an irregular warfare office. It had existed down at a lower echelon within the Navy that was working for me while I was the commander at Fleet Forces Command. When I became CNO, I brought that organization up into my staff in the Pentagon, where we are better able to move money and capitalize on ideas that we believe are helpful to the warfighter. And I would add that an example of this is those of you who watched the rescue of the captain of the Maersk Alabama. There was an unmanned vehicle flying off of one of our guided missile destroyers. That is not a program of record to be on that ship, but through the work of the IW office, we were able to have that unmanned vehicle on board, providing the ISR that I believe was critical. And what the IW office allows me to do is to see those capabilities and move them quickly out. Sometimes the introduction of them is what I call a photo finish, and sometimes they don't deliver the full capability that we envision. But if we always go for the perfect, we throw a lot of good out in the process, and I don't think that's the way that we have to move forward with the Navy. I also had the opportunity to elevate the Director of Naval Intelligence to a 3-star position, and that has significantly changed and put the Navy's intel structure back into the game in a big way. And the officer that's filling that position, Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett is the best in the business in my book, and he has really set us on a good vector as it applies to intelligence in the world that we live in today. Through his leadership, we stood up the National Maritime Intelligence Center out of Suitland, Maryland. We've also created four other intelligence centers, the Nimitz Operational Intelligence Center, which aligns our global network operations centers and provides intelligence to them, the Farragut Technical Analysis Center, which is focused on scientific and technological research, development, and proliferation of foreign technologies, the Kennedy Irregular Warfare Center, which supports our Special Warfare and our Expeditionary Combat Command, and the Hopper Information Services Center, which provides the mission-related information technology. And all that has been done in about 1 year's time, and Navy intelligence is on the move once again. The other thing that I've been doing is spending a fair amount of time focused on our industrial base. There are some who would say that it's not the job of the CNO to worry about the industrial base. I worry about the industrial base. It drives decisions, and its health and its viability is important to the United States Navy, particularly in the area of shipbuilding, where the United States Navy is the source of work for the shipbuilding industry. And Alan, I'm sure you would agree with that. And we have also worked very hard in this past year to take a look at our budget and move what had been a reliance on supplemental budgets and get that into our base budget so that we have a good understanding of what it takes to run the Navy, and as supplementals wax and wane, to minimize the effects on that. For example, we took our Expeditionary Combat Command, and now we have that in the base budget. It had been running purely on supplementals, which was not a good place for that organization to be, and particularly for the capabilities that we were pushing forward into the fight. I believe that the QDR is going to allow us to continue to examine the investments that we've made, the programs that we have, and the structures that we use to keep all of that working the way that it needs to. I am a great proponent of QDR, and I know Michelle Flournoy was here day before yesterday to talk about her approach and the way that she sees it. I have my QDR rep, Admiral Bill Burke, who has been given the task of orchestrating the Navy's QDR activities, and he may agree with what Tony Cordesman said a few weeks ago, that I'll quote or paraphrase him, that if God really hates you, he'll assign you to the QDR. So, Bill, don't read anything into that at all. I mean, it's there. But I really do believe that QDR is a good way for us to get the issues on the table. I talked about some of the directions that we have started to move the Navy. The 10 budget is the start of that, and I'm pleased with how we as a Navy are standing at the end of that. But QDR is going to be extraordinarily important to us. As far as how I'm looking at the QDR, to me, it's all about the type of capabilities that we want to put out in the world in which we live and in which our successors in the Navy will live. And my belief is that we're going to continue to see a world that is extremely interconnected, but that interconnectedness is very fragile, and it is easily disrupted in our disorderly world that we are living in. I am not an alarmist, but I do believe that the disorder that we see is going to continue for some time. I believe that the economic situation that the world finds itself in is going to exacerbate some of that disorder, and it will take place in places that navies operate. The case in point, or one example, are the teenage pirates that pirated the Maersk Alabama. I think you're going to continue to see activities like that, increases in transnational criminal activity, whether it's the trafficking in drugs and or people or weapons. We are also going to face threats that I think are going to span a whole spectrum of conflict, and our ability as a Navy to operate in that spectrum will be one that will dominate the approach that we take to QDR. You know, the word du jour, the hybrid warfare, is something that a lot of folks talk about, but I would submit that the United States Navy has been involved in hybrid warfare for a couple of centuries. It's kind of ironic that as we chase pirates off the coast of Africa, one has to be reminded that we began chasing pirates off the coast of Africa. So we've kind of gone full circle. The decisions that I've made are based also upon the proliferation of weapons that are taking place. Those are fairly sophisticated in the form of ballistic missiles. If you look at going back to the beginning of the 90s, about every third year, another country develops a ballistic missile capability. And so we're seeing that grow. We're seeing the capabilities grow. We're seeing anti-ship cruise missiles proliferate around. April of 2006 was an important month because that was when a terrorist group, Hezbollah, fired a fairly sophisticated cruise missile at an Israeli ship and almost sank it. And that changes the calculus as you operate in and around littoral areas. And that proliferation, in my mind, is not going to stop. So I don't think that it's going to be easy to classify warfare as low-end or high-end anymore. It's going to be a spectrum, and the challenge that we have is how do we take what we buy as a Navy, and how do we train our people, our sailors, to operate across the broadest band of that range of conflict? And that is what I look forward to doing in QDR. There are going to be some new areas where it will be required for us as a Navy and clearly as a military to spend a bit more time on. The littoral areas, I believe, are going to become increasingly important. We currently have about 70% of the world's population that lives within about 100-200 mile band of the coast around the world. So you have this compression of population down into the littorals. And oftentimes when people talk about the Navy, the littoral seems to be from the shoreline out. I consider the littoral to be the shoreline out and the shoreline in. Anywhere where we can have the reach, and of course our reach is becoming greater and greater. The world of cyber is going to dominate thinking and investment in a significant way over the next few years. Cyber, as many folks would look at it, and as you look at the ubiquitous PowerPoint slides that have the lightning bolts going up to the satellites and running around on Earth, that's not cyberspace. Cyberspace is on the bottom of the ocean, because 95% of what moves in cyberspace moves on cables that rest on the bottom of the ocean. That's the maritime domain. That's the domain of the United States Navy. And the entire undersea area for resources, I believe the resource competition in the future will also drive what we do and where we do it. I believe that our involvement globally has to continue, and the reason for that is our global interests will not wane, and if we have global interests, therefore we must be a global Navy, and the nation must have the global reach that's required to influence events and provide to the Commander-in-Chief options from which he has a basis to move. The maritime strategy that we issued right about 20 months ago still guides what we do in the Navy. That strategy highlighted six capabilities that will remain in the fore for me, and it's in those six capabilities that as I look at a program or a policy or some approach that we're taking if it doesn't support as many of those capabilities as it possibly can, then I begin to ask questions about, are we on the right path? The capabilities are to remain a forward Navy, to remain a deterrent force for the nation, to be able to provide power projection. That power projection can come off of our aircraft carriers, off of our submarines and surface combatants, but it also can come out of our amphibious ships in the form of United States Marines. To be able to provide humanitarian assistance and disaster response, and the humanitarian assistance can be proactive as well as reactive, and then to provide for maritime security. And the foundation for maritime security will be maritime domain awareness, knowing what's moving on, under, and above the ocean, and how do we as decision makers have a view of that, and how are we better able to make decisions. The force that we have and the force that has those capabilities, I believe, can assure our friends and partners and allies, and it can also deter those who wish us harm. And the Navy will also be the force that can be present, that can influence events, that can provide options, that does not infringe on anyone's sovereignty, because we continue with our Marine partners to reside offshore. Because I believe in the future, sensitivities of sovereignty are going to become more acute as we move into that future. And the smaller the footprint, the better it is. And as we talk about being able to influence events, I think it's important to think about what it is that you need. And there can be a tendency as we talk about security cooperation or the strategies of engagement, that the way to do it is to be small, cheap, and benign. And I am not sure that that is always the right path. There are some who say that in order to influence events, for example, in the Gulf of Guinea, if we had some small patrol boats, we could take some of the sailors from the coastal navies and teach them how to do fisheries patrol. I offer an alternative solution, which is what we're doing today off the coast of Africa with the USS Nashville, one of our oldest LPDs or landing ships that we have. Normally would be carrying Marines. In this instance, we have an international group of militaries on board. We have non-governmental organizations on board. And what we are able to do is to be able to show those small navies how to patrol fisheries areas or wherever it may be. We're able to bring their boats into the well deck of that ship and teach them how to maintain the boats, how to repair those boats. And because we're operating with an international staff of African naval officers and military officers, we are engaging at a level of leadership within those militaries that is pretty powerful when you get right down to it. It was my pleasure to visit Nashville right before she sailed from Norfolk. And this year when we did Africa Partnership, we brought the staff over, formed the staff in the United States. And when I said my farewells to the ship as it was about ready to depart, I was looking out not on a group of U.S. Sailors and officers, but on an international group primarily of African navies who were on the ship, would make the transit, would do the planning for the mission, and would also carry out that mission. And I think that's the way that we have to go forward. In order to maintain that presence, capacity is important. How much do you have to maintain the presence? And capacity is what we must have. It has to have relevant capabilities, but also sometimes you shape with power, and therefore combat power is key to that. And as we all know, one ship can only be in one place, so capacity matters. And right now, we are the smallest Navy that we have been since 1916. You have to go back to that time to find a Navy as small as the one that we currently have, that it is sitting at 283 ships right now. I believe that the littoral combat ship, the joint high-speed vessel, are the real number drivers as we move into the future. And in addition to their capabilities, that capacity is important to me. the centerpiece of the fleet. A lot of folks will look at us and see it as our aircraft carriers. They still are very relevant to the types of missions that we do. In the early days of Operation Enduring Freedom, 80% of the strike missions came off of U.S. aircraft carriers. We are currently in the major combat phase of Operation Iraqi Freedom, providing about 65% of the fixed wing, and right now we're providing about, half of all of the fixed wing operations there. Our strike fighter capacity is something that I look at very carefully and monitor carefully, and what will be a topic of discussion during the QDR with the need for us to make a decision on how we avoid a shortfall that begins in 2012 and peaks in 2017 as we await the arrival of the Joint Strike Fighter. Some of the options there are to extend the current Hornet fleet, but also to consider whether or not Super Hornets figure into that solution as well. QDR will also cause us to take a look at amphibious shipping. And as I have mentioned, it's not only important for our power projection missions and for the role of the United States Marine Corps, but as I mentioned, the Nashville, the LPD, is an amphibious ship performing a rather non-traditional role for our Navy. Flexibility is going to be important, and how do you get that which you buy to span the most of the spectrum of operations? And I highlight the role of the guided missile destroyers that we currently have in service. Bainbridge was the ship from which the rescue of Captain Phillips was staged. It was the McFall that was the first ship, a DDG, that sailed into Georgia after the Russian invasion. And it was the Steedham, the Shiloh, the Curtis Wilbur, and the Fitzgerald that tracked the North Korean Taepodong missile when it was fired just a couple of weeks ago. People. All of the stuff that we have is really irrelevant, and it really gets down to people and the manpower that we have in the Navy. Our sailors today are absolutely extraordinary. They're performing missions that we never thought they would do over the Christmas holidays, standing on a mountaintop, rather cold mountaintop in Afghanistan, talking to a provincial reconstruction team leader who is a nuclear submarine commander, leading a group of 80 people doing some incredible work. But we also are seeing recruiting and retention in numbers that we have not seen before, thanks to the economy. That's the positive side of it. But it's also causing some pretty significant pressures on the budget as we have to make payroll, as any company has to make payroll. But we have the best Navy today in which I have ever served, and I couldn't be more proud of what our people are doing and the way that our families support us in that work. So I think that we do have some great opportunities ahead in the QDR. It will give us a chance to address some of these fundamental issues about the type of military that the nation needs, the type of Navy that the nation needs. It gives us, I think, a unique opportunity to have discussions, and I look forward to that. And as I tell my leadership team, now is the best time to lead in the United States Navy. It's always easy to lead when the manna is falling from heaven, but now is when it matters, and now is when we have to make the best decisions for the Navy and for the nation. And contrary to what Tony Cordesman said, I don't think God hates me, and I'm really ready to dig into the QDR. So I'll take any questions you may have.
Thank you, sir. Before we open for questions, I do want to take the opportunity to acknowledge the gratitude of CSIS for the underwriter of this Military Strategy Forum, and in fact for all of this series of Military Strategy Forum. That is Rolls-Royce North America. I focused a little bit on our nonpartisan aspect early on. We are also, of course, nonprofit, and so we do rely upon the kindness of our friends in order to continue to function. So it's important for us to thank Steve Plummer and Rolls-Royce North America for their support. Here's how we're going to do the questions. You will raise your hand if you have a question you want to ask. I will call on you. You will wait for the microphone. You will actually use the microphone. to speak your question into it. We're going to take two or three questions together, and then we'll throw them to the CNO for answering, and then we'll look for some more folks to call on. The host will take the prerogative not of the first question, but instead for the last question, so that way I'll get to ask the one that nobody else asks as we go along. So raise your hand if you've got interest. Wait for the mic. Let's start at the table over here, and we'll take both of those together. And here comes the microphone.
Bill Court.
Good plan. Yeah, I also should say identify yourself. Thanks.
CSC. How do you see the future of IT in the Navy?
Eric McVeigh, the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis. Admiral, you said it was your fourth time with Admiral Wu Xiongli in Qingdao. I wonder how you would characterize the trend that we have with the PLA Navy. Are we trending more toward things like the Gulf of Aden and the Global Maritime Partnership and so forth? Or are we concentrating on anti-access, and how should we be going?
Right. Thanks. Two very related questions, and I'll take them in that way. With regard to IT in the Navy, I believe that we in the Navy have held a leadership or a significant role in information technology. We, like the Air Force, tend to be a service that relies extraordinarily heavily on that. I also would say that that it is the Navy that has a significant part of the educational process for IT, and I'm kind of lumping all of cyber into that. The challenges that I think we face are on the manpower side. The manning models that often are put up are more resemble more the way that we approached more traditional operations in joint task force type structures, and we're going after a particular objective, and my concern with regard to the IT manning models, the cyber manning models of the future, is that they're unsustainable. Manpower is something that is going to be very critical. The costs, as I alluded to, are significant, and the type of individual that's going to be involved in that type of work is going to be rare, and it's going to be a very competitive environment. Because in the case of IT and cyber, it's not a military thing. I have been struck by the fact that I can open up the Washington Post, and I don't see a lot of ads for Hornet pilots, but I see a lot of ads for system administrators and people who really understand that business. So I think it's going to become pretty competitive for us, but we've got to get the manning model right in that regard. With regard to the PLA Navy, I believe that the relationship that we have with the PLA and the PLA Navy is going to be one that doesn't quite fit in either mold. I would like the future to be one of the type of cooperative activities we have going on in the Gulf of Aden, and those operations are going very well. And the exchange of information that takes place between our ships and theirs and the command structure, I think has gone extremely well. The challenges that we will face as we continue to operate in their EEZ, as I mentioned to Admiral Wu, he and I disagree on the interpretation of the law as it applies, but that what we have to agree on is a way that the behavior goes in the EEZ, and there can be nothing that puts at risk our ships and especially our people as we do that.
Let's move to the front here and here. So we'll do the three front tables, and then we'll move towards the rear deck.
Admiral, I'm Mitzi Wirth.
Hi, Mitzi. How are you? Good to see you.
Sabrowski Institute at the Naval Postgraduate School. Among the key issues for the president are both energy and climate. How does that fit into the Navy's QDR?
Thanks, David. Sir Vaga Maranian from Defense News.
Vaga.
We've seen a series of accidents, and there are a couple of in-serve reports that have had some troubling
right.
trends highlighted in them in terms of even the surface force's ability to fight major space fires. How much of this do you think is some of the innovative ideas that have been put in play, whether it's ratings consolidation, whether it's training at the schoolhouse, too much time on simulators, and whether there's a wider fleet-wide problem that's going to take a lot of money to be able to solve and a lot of time?
Okay.
I yield the balance of my time to you.
Tim Davis from Davidson Consulting Services. Michelle Flohr and I talked to us the other day, and she talked said that we can't do it alone. And what I wanted to see is what's the Navy doing in the QDR to talk about building partnership capacity among our coalition partners.
Okay, great. Thank you. On energy and climate, about 9 months ago, we put together an energy task force. It's always easy to say I've got a task force, so there I'm handling the problem. But I would submit to you that we're doing things a little bit differently, because not only are we looking at current energy demands, but future energy demands. When I look at the energy reserves that will be available, and even though the Navy and the Department of Defense is a blip on the national energy consumption, it's still important that we get our arms around that. So we're looking at current and future, and this gets into the idea of total ownership costs. So when someone comes in to talk to me about a particular program, they better be ready to talk about manpower, and they better be ready to talk about total ownership costs. Otherwise, it's going to be a real short conversation. And the other aspect is we're looking at our shore side, which, quite frankly, we've had a lot more activity with regard to innovative energy ideas ashore than we have had at sea. But I now have NAVC involved in this task force as well, and we're going after some opportunities that we believe are on the afloat side. And if you can get 5 or 10% per ship, that begins to start to add up. So we're doing that. With regard to the ability of us to maintain and man and support our ships, I know that there's the current in-serve report is on its way up to me. The don't like to see any degradations, but what we are seeing is about a historical norm over time. As I move around, I see ships that are very capable of performing their missions. One of the things that we did a few years ago is we removed the engineering process from our surface ship life cycle management. We have a great process for submarines. We have a great process for aircraft carriers. But because of some other oversight things we were doing, we thought we could remove the engineering oversight from that. That was a mistake. We now have reinstituted a life cycle engineering process. We have taken people out of HIDE, out of the NAVC structure, to begin to get ourselves back into an engineered cycle for our surface ships, which we need to do because we have to make sure we're performing the right maintenance, but I also believe we have to make sure that we're not performing maintenance at periodicities that we don't have to and that we can apply those funds elsewhere. So that's what we're doing there. With regard to the cooperative efforts that we had, the strategy that we issued is actually called a cooperative strategy for 21st century sea power. And from that, we have seen the growth in coalition activity and in the way that we are working with regional navies around the world. If you would have told me that the countries that are represented in the Gulf of Aden would be assembled and working as effectively as they are 4 or 5 years ago, I would have said, I don't know what part of the world you're talking about. But we do have a very good cooperative effort working there. In fact, our counterpiracy task force is about ready to be taken over by a Turk, which I'm very comfortable with that. Africa Partnership Station is another example. The Comfort Hospital ship is now sailing down into Central and South America. Pacific Partnership is going into the South Pacific and Oceania. The regional ties that we're making are significant. The last International Sea Power Symposium in Newport 2 years ago had 98 countries represented, and we'll be hosting the next International Sea Power Symposium this October 6 through 9. So the fact that I'm traveling around and visiting the places that I visit is great, but I will tell you it is for the main purpose of building those partnerships and trying to come together with a common view. And I think the Gulf of Aden is a great example of how that can work.
Let's move to the rear of the room. We've got one question here. a second question here, and I'll let the third question be back against the wall there. So, JJ.
Admiral J.J. Gertler, AIA, and Senior Associate CSIS. Excuse me. Good to see you again, sir. You spoke of the importance of hybrid warfare in the QDR and in defining the Navy's future. How is the Navy thinking about hybrid warfare in the blue water?
Yeah. I think that the nature of warfare – I'm sorry. We're going to take a couple more, and I'll get on there.
You're welcome to flow right into your answer.
I'll keep going here. I like the clusters.
John Donnelly with Congressional Quarterly. You expressed concern about the industrial base. Besides wanting it to be healthy, is there anything in particular that you are keeping an eye on or need to manage with particular care?
Thomas Spies, Captain, German Navy. What is the U.S. Navy's reaction in regard to the melting Arctic and the new ways you can ship around there?
Great. With regard to hybrid warfare in the blue water, I think that at the present time there are not that many nations, navies that operate in the blue. Clearly, we are the dominant navy in the blue water. There is no question that China has an ambition to move out there. And Russia is a blue water navy that is episodically venturing back out into that again. But I do believe that the things that I'm looking at with regard to the blue water, and particularly some of the undersea resources and communication issues, I think that's a place that is absolutely ripe for unmanned systems to play. I will make an editorial about my view on unmanned systems. There is no such thing as an unmanned system. There may be a pilotless airplane. There may be an uncrewed submersible. But they all have manpower associated with them. And if we don't take that dimension into account as we envision the future, we will generate an unsustainable bill. So you can tell I've been in Washington for as long as I have. I talk about money a lot. But I think that's an area that we really need to play into. With regard to the industrial base, there's no question about my main focus there really is shipbuilding and the shipbuilding industrial base. Airplanes, another one that's important. Pleased to see that we flew our first P-8, the replacement for the P-3, last week, and a significant milestone for us. But looking at the base that we have that manufactures our airplanes is also key. I would also say that when it comes to our industrial base, and particularly as it applies to shipbuilding, there's a phrase often heard that shipbuilding is broken. I don't believe that at all. You don't have a broken shipbuilding industry and build Virginia-class submarines or Nimitz-class aircraft carriers or Arleigh Burke destroyers. If it's broken, you can't build that. There's no question there are some things that we have to do with the industrial base. And I believe, given the fragility of the base and the fact that the Navy is really the game in town, it will be important that we work with that base early on with the leadership of those industries and have a common view of what it is that we need and where we're going, as opposed to waiting to the end game and then slogging it out. So I think we have to have a different approach there. With regard to the Arctic, we are looking at that. I would submit that there are some who envision transportation routes that are running up through there. I do not believe that that will take place in the near term. To be sure, the ice pack does retreat. We're seeing a diminishment of the old ice. But as far as transportation goes, I think you will still have impediments to transport because of large pieces of ice that will still be floating up there. I think the first press into the Arctic is going to be in the area of resources and the claims that countries will be staking out for that. And for that reason, that's why I believe it's important for the United States to accede to the UN Convention on Law of the Sea. I believe that having a seat at the table is very important in the future.
I know we have
Still one question here and a question here. We'll do those two, and then I'll reserve the final question.
Good morning, Admiral. Otto Kreischer with the Congress Daily and others. You mentioned some of the decisions that Secretary Gates made on procurement, some of your ship programs. You know, some of them you agreed with, but the amphibious ships, LHA, and the mobile landing platform have impact on your future, your sea basing concept. Are you concerned at all that you're going to lose those in the QDR?
Yes, Admiral Steve Benson from Census Corporation and a fellow at CSIS. The Army just put out its first EW manual in a decade. We intend to operate more often closer to the shore with a higher capacity of vessels in the future. But what are we doing about EW in these complex environments? If you could address that, please.
Okay. All right. With regard to amphibious shipping, and the fact that we're going to be bringing it up in the QDR, I'm not alarmed, or I wouldn't begin to predict that we'll lose those ships. That said, I believe it will be important to have a good discussion about what the structure should be and the role, particularly of the MPFF, or the Maritime Prepositioned Force of the future. So I look forward to that. The fact of the matter is that right now we have ships booked in our amphibious building yards. So to have added another ship in that category, it would have been a booked ship. So I'm comfortable with where we are, and I look forward to the discussions. With regard to electronic warfare, I'm pleased that the Navy has been able to play the role that it has ashore in Iraq and Afghanistan. We have several hundred of our electronic warfare experts that are part of our 14,000 sailors on the ground in the Middle East. In fact, I have more sailors serving in Iraq and Afghanistan than I have on ships at sea, and I have 10,000 at sea right now in the Middle East. But our EW people have made a significant contribution. I see some other uniforms here, and if you ever want to talk to somebody who, in my mind, has made a huge contribution to that, you need to look no further than the gentleman in khakis right behind you, Dave Woods, who led our effort over there and really brought some structure and capability and capacity to a mission that was absolutely key. EW is part of who we are. We operate in an electronic environment. We live in that environment, and therefore we have a sense about it, and we have maintained that capability. We are very mindful that in future conflicts, controlling that spectrum is going to be important. Being able to ensure that we can operate in the spectrum where we want to be and denying adversaries and operate the ability to operate in that spectrum is going to be key. That's what we've been doing for years. We're going to continue to do it. It becomes more complex as time goes on, but that's why we have the pros like Dave back there to do that.
Admiral, let me ask the final question, and we'll let you get back to your other matters, but I'll make up for it by having it be a two-part question. So.
Great.
Secretary Gates talks about rebalancing, and he divides the budget into three categories. He says about 50% is dedicated to the conventional and strategic aspects of what some call the old way of doing war, 10% is on the new irregular warfare, and 40% is what he calls both. The two parts of my questions, number one is, how do you think Secretary Gates sees the Navy in terms of those three categories, and where do you see the Navy headed as a result of the budget in those three categories?
Mm-hmm. I won't answer on behalf of Secretary Gates. I'll let him form his own opinion on that. I do believe that we as a Navy, because of the capabilities that we have that are in our Special Operations Force, our SEALs, Naval Expeditionary Combat Command, the the growth that we have put into explosive ordnance disposal. I believe that we are moving the Navy, particularly with NECC, getting that into the base budget. I think we're making the appropriate moves there. We did our first force structure analysis on NECC since we stood it up about 4 years ago, and that has been a helpful exercise for us. We clearly have a niche at one end of the spectrum of conflict, which is with our strategic force and our ballistic submarine force. To me, is the significant component of our deterrent. So I think that, you know, we have that part of the high end. I would also submit that the ability for us to flex our capability. For example, a Hornet is a great fighter. It really is an extraordinary fighter, the ENF. Yet it is, as I said, flying about half of the fixed-wing missions in the Middle East today. We've been able to adapt that airplane into an electronic warfare version. And when you go into Iraq or Afghanistan and you see the work that what someone would say is a very high-end type of airplane that would be used in strike, whether it's at sea or ashore, it's those young men and women flying those airplanes that are saving lives by defeating IEDs, and also the term I use, herding insurgents within the electromagnetic spectrum to where we want them or don't want them. I think that's a pretty good mix of capability. I cited the role that our guided missile destroyers have played, from counter-piracy to delivering humanitarian assistance to tracking objects in space. That's a pretty good spread on the spectrum as well. Our submarine force, which is the most incredible weapon that we have in our arsenal, and as the Pacific Fleet Commander, as I said, it was the most important arrow in the quiver. I referred to it as, if you're playing chess, a nuclear submarine is the invisible queen. Tremendous power that you can put wherever you want it, wherever you need it, to do whatever you need it to do. It also has functions beyond simply war fighting, and they are worth their weight in gold. So I believe that we're spreading ourselves nicely. We have to continue to take a harder look at some of the capabilities that can be put into play in the IW area. And so that's the reason why we're why I brought the IW piece up into my staff, and I refuse any attempts to make it part of the normal bureaucratic process, because I'm afraid it will get buried in the inertia of the way we normally go about doing business. So, we have a force that I believe is spread well. Is it optimized? That is something that I really look forward to QDR to be able to dig into. I have, in my opinion, a great leadership team on my staff. We spend a lot of time getting out of our portfolios and talking about things that matter to the Navy and the nation. And when we go into those sessions, I make everybody check their portfolio at the door, and we are there as senior leaders in the United States Navy trying to come to the best decisions for today and tomorrow that we possibly can. So thank you.
What a great group. I was going to say, please remain in your seats and join me for a round of applause, and you already followed instructions. We're going to move straight into our panel here now, and so I'd ask the panel to please come on up to the stage as we set out your name tags, and hopefully there'll be some alignment between your name tag and where you sit, or else we'll arrange them. They put it on both sides so you can see. We eventually learn our lessons here. Moderating the panel this morning is retired Admiral. Yes, you do need to grab this. Thank you. Retired Admiral Steve Petropoli of the—he's the executive director of the Navy League—and in my opinion, it is upon his broad shoulders that will fall the need to sustain the fleet in the event that all the other forces at work here tend to fade into the distance here. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the microphone and the podium over to our moderator, Admiral Petropoli.
Thank you, David. With that introduction, clearly we are a nation and a Navy at some peril. But I will dispense. You all have bios out there. I'm going to... I'm sorry. I thought I had this on. The Quadrennial Defense Review is kind of an inside-the-beltway parlor game every 4 years. But there's no doubt that this year in particular, the potential implications for all of the services, and particularly the maritime forces, are significant. From ships to tactical aircraft to, as was mentioned a moment ago, amphibious lift, a maritime positioning force. Many of you heard Secretary Flournoy 2 days ago speak about the QDR in very lofty terms, strategic concepts, complex scenarios, diverse threats, you know, five threats, six priorities, et cetera. But the reality is, at the end of the day, the Defense Department, like the Congress, talks about its priorities with what it funds, where it puts its money. And we are fortunate today to have experienced and diverse panel of background to walk us through some of the QDR issues with respect to Navy operations and Navy and Marine Corps programs. First, Byron Callen, highly regarded financial analyst with extensive experience in aerospace and electronic defense industries and a reputation for prizing personal credibility above all other attributes. Dr. Eric Labs is well known in this town for his exceptional analyses of naval programs and in particular for his keen and dogged efforts to get at ground truth about just what it will actually cost to produce the Navy shipbuilding program of record. Finally, Christine Fox, to my immediate right, president of the Center for Naval Analyses, who has not allowed her administrative responsibilities as president to crowd out her nearly 3 decades of superb analytical work for the center. She continues to be involved in every facet of the center's work. Each panelist will have an opportunity to make some opening comments, either on what the CNO has said, what the CNO meant to say, what the CNO didn't say, or their own view of what is really going to be at play in the QDR for Navy and naval forces. And then we'll get to the discussion in Q&A. I'd like to begin with Byron, and we'll go to Dr. Labs, and finally to Christine. So, Byron, if you'll kick it off.
Yeah, thank you, and good morning, everybody. Obviously, the QDR is going to touch on a lot of industrial-based issues, but I just want to frame out a couple of deal with Navy shipbuilding, because that's really in a class in its own. The CNO addressed this as an issue that he's focused on, but I just want to make 4 quick points, and then we can pick some of these up in Q&A. I think the first point I want to make is just the very structure of this industry right now makes any idea about sweeping change very hard from a political or even economic reality. The Tier 1 yards tend to be located in states with below national average median income levels. They create high-paying jobs in those states. And they're large employers in those states. Bath Iron Works, I think, is now the second largest employer after L.L. Bean, but Ingalls is, I believe, the largest employer in Mississippi and Alabama. Virginia, I believe, Newport News is the largest private employer in the state of Virginia. So any thought of significant change, I think, has to also take these realities into account that these are businesses that provide a very healthy living for people in areas that are less fortunate than other parts of the country. The second point I'd want to make was just really the industrial-based issues are critical because there's not a lot of fallback room in this industry compared to other sectors of the defense market. The U.S. doesn't have a globally competitive commercial shipbuilding business. There are clearly differences with military aerospace and commercial aerospace, but there is, in some cases, a common supply base that those businesses can draw off of. I think I saw a figure the U.S. builds about 1% of the world's gross commercial tonnage, and most of that is dedicated for U.S. markets. So there's not a commercial business that this industry can easily fall back on as a cushion to manage the changes that may emerge in shipbuilding in the coming decade. I think another important point to make about the industrial base is that the workforce is really pretty unique here. You know, if I go to shipyards, you typically see it takes about 4 to 9 years to build basic competency. for some of the people who work in these yards. In some areas, it's another 3 to 5 years to really become proficient in things like nuclear welding. The yards do a lot of their own training. You don't have vocational schools in many of these states that provide a workforce. There are apprentice programs at these yards. So changes in the yards themselves are going to have a ripple-through effect in the industrial workforce that's not going to be easily or readily reconstituted. The third point I wanted to make is, you know, in a lot of businesses these days, you know, stability and predictability and design are really seem to be ill-suited in a world that is arguably anything but stable and predictable. But I really do think in shipbuilding, you know, this is one area that is very important to address, the idea that we can have longer, stable production runs. It should result in lower unit costs, and I think you will see some of the time-honored effects of things like learning curves and economies of scale for longer production runs. So that's going to be true of the Tier 1 yards and certainly true of the Tier 2 yards. And the companies are willing to make investments when they see that kind of visibility to a business opportunity. My fourth point, I just want to put some ideas out that we can debate and discuss in Q&A. One, you know, should we buy hulls from lower-wage suppliers outside the United States and put electronics on them? They're built by U.S. companies, U.S. systems. As an investor, you know, capital will go where there are opportunities. So, you know, if someone tells me the Korean yard is going to be building U.S. naval vessels, we'll buy the stock. As a citizen, I think it's an awful idea. Should the yards be in the hands of public companies? Should they, in fact, should the government do more of this? I think, you know, back to the CNO's point, this is not a broken industry. I don't see what public ownership would really do differently and maybe reverse some of the gains and progress that the private industry has made. Should there be further consolidation among the shipyards? I think it really depends on what kind of risk the nation is willing to take. We saw with Katrina, there's actually a pretty good advantage to having two surface yards in very different parts of the country. And the final point, you know, should there be more incentives for cost reduction on existing programs? Yes, I think the profit motive will work as well in this industry as well in any other sector. Those are my remarks.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Labs?
Thank you very much. I want to say at the outset that the views I express here today are my own, and they're not those of the Congressional Budget Office or the U.S. Congress. And in general, I'd like to make three points that refer to the Navy and the QDR process generally, and they will touch on some of the things that Admiral Ruffett had said specifically. The first is that I think, in my view, that the Navy is probably in the weakest position of the services heading into the QDR. Clearly, one of the things that the Navy is going to want out of the QDR process is they want its 313-ship plan validated. But that's a plan that's going to require in the neighborhood of $25 to $27 billion a year on average for 30 years. Over the past 15 years, the Navy has been receiving for shipbuilding about $11 billion a year, and the 2009 budget was about $14.5 billion. It is not at all clear where that extra $10 to $12 billion a year is going to come from on a recurring annual basis. The requirements in that ship plan, moreover, were based almost entirely on conventional war planning. The Navy's maritime strategy that the Admiral Ruff had referred to came out after the 313-ship requirement was developed. And so far, from what we have seen, that strategy has not had an effect on the 313-ship plan. Maybe the Navy's next 30-year shipbuilding plan will reflect the impact of that strategy, but from what I'm hearing, the Navy's not going to put out a 30-year shipbuilding plan this year. So we'd have to wait at least another year to see that effect. And based on, you know, what has been published so far in the press, statements, things that have come out from the Secretary of Defense Office, the QDR certainly seems to be heavily focused on the irregular warfare, the asymmetric threats, you know, which have not been much featured in the development of the 313-ship plan. The Navy is doing a very good job, for example, of articulating why the United States needs a Navy. But they've not been doing a very good job articulating why the United States Navy needs the Navy they say they need, the 313-ship plan. Now, my second point flows largely from the first, and maybe is better as a subpoint. You know, to the extent that the Navy is constrained or prevented or unable to talk about the potential maritime competition from other countries, and here I'm really talking about China, it makes it hard for the Navy to lay out the conceptual and analytic basis that it needs to for the high-value items in its fleet, the carriers, the submarines, the cruisers, and the destroyers. And this is the one issue that the Navy does very much need to talk about to help make the case for closing that $10 to $12 billion gap one way or another. Press reports indicate that Secretary Gates has said that they wanted to order a look in the QDR process of scenarios that were realistic. That was the word that was used. But realism, as we all know, is kind of in the eye of the beholder. And there were sort of four categories of scenarios that were talked about: U.S.-led stability and reconstruction operations, steady-state demands, although I'm not really sure what that means, major conflicts against state adversaries, and defense of the homeland and civil support. In my view, really only the third of those argues for the very high-end platforms that the Navy is going to want and need to buy over the next 30 years. Now, obviously, naval forces play a role in all of those, but it is the most expensive platforms and arguably the most desired platforms that appear vulnerable in the QDR process to me. And give one illustration of that, there was one recent press report that indicated that Navy's amphibious ships are coming under some tough scrutiny in the studies, QDR studies process. And they are not what I put in the category of the highest-end platforms. And it's ironic because they are some of the most useful platforms for some of the irregular warfare, humanitarian, and partnership activities that even Admiral Ruff had alluded to in his statement. And then finally, my last point. It seems to me that the QDR, to be effective, is going to be about making choices. And with respect to the Navy, we have really reached the point where we can no longer credibly talk about doing more with less or getting more efficiencies about this, that, or the other thing. But decisions are going to need to be made about whether there are activities that we might have expected the Navy to do in the past that we can't really expect them to do in the future or in 20 years' time. The gap, on the one hand, between the Navy's stated requirement for ships and, on the other hand, the amount of money it has been receiving or is likely to receive and to buy new ships is so large that no amount of tweaking at the margins is going to close that gap. Choices are going to have to be made. Things will have to be given up. That doesn't mean the Navy will have to give up anything. After all, the cuts could come from elsewhere in the defense establishment and government. But frankly, there is nothing in the past 40 years of DOD financing that suggests that Navy can expect its bills to be paid by somebody else.
Thank you, Eric. And finally, Christine.
Thank you very much, Admiral. It's a pleasure to be here. Today I want to also talk a little bit about QDR in the Navy and some of the challenges of looking at a force like the Navy has through the lens of QDR. QDR is an opportunity to take stock of the force, but they look at that force every 4 years. So if you think of it, to this coming QDR is going to look at pretty much the same force that the last QDR looked at. In fact, 17 of today's 29 Arleigh Burke DDGs and 7 of today's 10 Nimitz-class carriers were commissioned before there ever was a QDR. So what QDRs do is they tend to put a stamp of the current world on a force that actually spans many QDRs. What this does is it pushes the existing forces through a changing lens, and I think it's important that we are careful that that process does not distort the true picture of the potential role and value of those forces. I'd like to use an example of aircraft carriers, and I think we've heard some of that even today. After the last QDR, carriers started to go over into a category of Cold War relic. They started to be considered as high-end platforms that were only valuable in the MCO scenarios. To that, we have now added in our current thinking that MCOs are unlikely. Well, MCOs are unlikely, carriers are MCO forces. Well, we don't really need many of them. And then on top of that, we start to look at the vulnerability of carriers, and we can pretty soon talk ourselves into a view of the world, QED, we don't need carriers. This logic has been applied recently to more than just carriers, cruisers, destroyers, SSNs, a lot of the naval forces. And so the question, I think, for this QDR, is that the right lens? And I would submit to you, no. CNA has done a lot of analysis over the years of naval operations. I can tell you that until 2001, carrier strike groups were used routinely in NEOs, peace operations, show of forces, humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, and combat operations. These operations were conducted concurrently, and they span multiple theaters. Recently, the imperative of the current wars, which is a clearly important imperative, coupled with the declining force structure, has combined to concentrate those carrier strike groups into the CENTCOM AORs in support of Iraq and Afghanistan. Peace and show of force operations have essentially fallen off of the list. And I guess the question for this QDR is that okay? Is that consistent with the needs of the future? Secretary Gates has written and spoken eloquently on his strategic views of that future, and I submit to you that the answer is no. He talks about the indirect approach, the needs for capacity building, the need to prevent festering problems from turning into crises, the importance of institutionalizing counterinsurgency, and he describes the long war, a war he believes will continue, as a worldwide irregular campaign. So if you look at the naval capabilities that suggests, it suggests things like presence and engagement for capacity building, engagement in show of force operations to prevent crises. The Navy has been conducting precision strike in support of soft and ground forces, institutionalizing counterinsurgency, and a prolonged irregular campaign, precision strikes, battle space dominance, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance. Naval forces conduct all of these missions, but as I said earlier, recently they've been more focused into kind of one area. Naval forces just don't fit into boxes. They last a very long time, and we have to be very good at adapting them. Carriers, again, are an example. Recently, they have been significantly reconfigured twice, first to provide a sea base for soft forces when they went into Afghanistan, and secondly, the sea base to support the humanitarian relief after the tsunami in Indonesia. These are examples of irregular warfare and partnership building. And yes, naval forces project power, and you know what? They're good at it. We've, again, done a lot of analysis of naval forces' ability to project powers. In the operation going into Afghanistan right after 2001, basically we enjoyed as a nation the most international support for any operation we've seen in a very long time. Yet access to bases and overflight was extremely restricted, even with all of that support. And if it weren't for the aircraft carriers, there wouldn't have been the important TAC air support of the SOF units that were operating with indigenous forces. Again, a form of irregular warfare. So if naval forces are long-lived, flexible assets, making them it makes them difficult to assess in a QDR. And so I will conclude with three questions that I think this QDR can actually address for naval forces that I think could be very important. First question is, how can the Navy regain the capacity it needs to simultaneously support those multiple missions that I talked about from the 1990s in multiple theaters? It's needed to support the current strategy of international engagement, deterrence, and the response to the war, or long war. I don't think that this can be solved by numbers alone. I think, obviously, operating concepts, perhaps basing options, should be considered, but this capacity issue is a major problem. I do think the strike fighter shortfall that was discussed earlier a little bit is a significant issue. We do have aircraft carriers, and they do exist to project power, even if we can reconfigure them. But you need aircraft to do that. Secretary Gates says the Defense Department should focus more on those 75% solutions. So I hope this QDR will try to take a really good look at the risks associated with focusing on the F-18EF as one of those 75% solutions, maybe even an 85 or 90% solution to the strike fighter shortfall. Finally, I think the most significant issue for this QDR is how can we make the Navy capabilities more affordable? And that's not just ships and the cost of ships, but the stuff, airplanes, electronics, radars, missile systems that go on it, and the people, the cost of the people that's needed to run them. I think this is also very tough in light of the fact that there are a lot of other nations out there that are very worried about naval capabilities, and they're very active in trying to develop capabilities to defeat them. Clearly, today, we have those nations worried. The goal is to keep them worried tomorrow, and that's going to be expensive. I think this is the most important question for QDR for the Navy. And to answer it, I think it requires an accurate lens through which to view the naval force and its ability to contribute to the broad spectrum of operations necessary to support the strategic needs that we see today.
Thank you, Christine. Okay, well, I think we've gotten three very clear and very different perspectives on what might be in the QDR. I'm going to take a page from David's book here and reserve to my right not the last question but the first question, and I'm going to do it like he did. I'm going to cluster three that I'm going to throw out there for the panel to ignore completely, seize on any of them, or seize on one of them, all three. So first, and Byron spoke to this, is it time to drop the pretense of competition in shipbuilding and jump on that nationalization bandwagon while it's the hot topic? Is the QDR the intensive analytical exercise that Secretary Flournoy described Wednesday, or is it more like one observer noted, a budget-cutting exercise masquerading as a strategic shift. And finally, if you speak to the Navy leadership on QDR, they will tell you that force structure per se, number of carriers, with the exception of amphibious lift and the landing platform, they'll tell you that number of carriers, force structure in general, is not a QDR topic. And to that, I just say, really? I'll leave that to any of the three of you.
There's not a lot of competition today if you think about things like the Virginia-class submarine. There's a lot more partnership going on in the Navy. Even littoral combat ship, I mean, I don't know how that's ultimately going to come out, but maybe the best answer is you have two very different hulls and ship types fulfilling that 55-ship requirement or greater requirement. Maybe another future surface combatant is a place where there will be design competition, but I think the realities of the way this industrial base is currently set up probably is going to mean the work's going to be parceled out to different yards.
Eric, do you have a view on that?
When it comes to issues, I would agree with Baron. I don't think there's a lot of competition today in the shipbuilding industry. I think what you see in terms of if you're trying to get to the extent that you can get costs down, you're going to see it a lot more by consolidating the numbers and types of hulls that you're building, building to some rate effect, get the learning curves that you can get. But I don't want anybody to think that if you do those things, that somehow solves your shipbuilding budget gap. It doesn't. It tweaks it at the margins, but it doesn't solve that $10 billion problem. As for the QDR being sort of a, whether it's a masquerading as a budget-cutting operation or not, or whether force structure is a related issue, I would agree that a QDR that doesn't talk about force structure really or budget issues really isn't worth very much. And that being said, you know, as Christine referred to about sort of the 75% solution maybe for the aircraft fighter gap, one of the things that I sound like that we're hearing coming out of Secretary Gates is that he's iterating towards a 10-carrier force, if for no other reason than the decision that was made to move to building them every 5 years, and then you sort of a steady state of 10 carriers a year starting in 2040. Well, if it's good for after 2040, and it's going to be good for 2013 to 2015 or 16 because of the retirement of the Enterprise and the Gerald Ford won't be ready, it might be good for all that time in between. And if it's good, 10 carriers is good for all that time in between, that goes a long way towards solving your fighter gap because you can cut a wing once you do that. So I don't see how the QDR can address force structure, if not directly, at least with some very strong signposts.
I'll just take a crack at the analytic question. As an analyst, of course, I would love to think it will be analytic, but I sincerely concerned that it won't be as analytic as perhaps we would like, and I think it does have to focus on these budget realities, and so I don't see how force structure cannot be a topic of this QDR.
Well, there you have it. If there are any questions left, we'll take them now from the floor. We'll do them one at a time because I can't keep things straight the way David can. And if you will, identify yourself and use the microphone as soon as it gets you. Right here, sir.
Eric McVaden, the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis. Thinking about things that Admiral Ruffhead didn't mention, these popped to mind for me. I think I heard the word sea basing from Ms. Fox for the first time this morning. I wonder whether there's any life left in that. UCAS, I mean carrier-based unmanned aircraft systems. BMD, ballistic missile defense against the developing Chinese anti-ship ballistic missile. And kind of in the same vein, the only anti-submarine warfare I remember Admiral Ruffhead mentioning was blue water capability for surface combatants. I kind of think about the Chinese submarine force and I think much more broadly than that.
Okay. Who wants to take first shot? Eric, your light's on.
That's because I forgot to turn it off last time.
Sorry. Sorry. That makes you it. You're it.
Lesson learned.
Yeah. Isn't that, though? Well, I mean, I think you're quite right that all of those are all four of those topics are important topics that the Navy's going to need to address in the future. I don't know what the Navy's current thinking is on something like UCAS or sea basing. My guess is that the Navy and the Marine Corps are not seeing eye to eye on that issue. There was a question that came up in Admiral Ruffhead's discussions about whether the decisions on LHA and the MLP are leading to sort of the death knell for that. I don't think that's true just yet. I mean, it was just a delay. It wasn't a cancellation. So I think it still remains to be seen sort of what the future of that concept is going to be. Any way you look at it, though, it's not going to be a major, in my opinion, sort of a it doesn't solve any of the major problems. Whether you keep sea basing or not, you're still going to need to buy amphibious ships if you want to maintain the force structure that you've got. And the operating concept can certainly change, but I'm sort of focused like a laser on sort of this budgetary problem, because in my view of things, you know, we can talk about strategy all you want, but I agree that at the end of the day, you know, what gets funded, tell me how much you're spending and I'll tell you what your strategy is. And that's sort of the way I kind of look at things. UCAS, I think, is an important area of the future, and I hope it's not something that the Navy neglects. We're starting to see some indications that maybe the Navy is going to neglect that or not put a higher priority on that, and I think that would be unfortunate. Because if you are worried about things like being able to exert your influence, you know, in the Western Pacific, and you are worried about the capabilities that other countries such as China is developing, having sort of a long-range unmanned strike asset, it seems to me, would be a very good thing. That being said, it's going to take a while to sort of make that work, develop that, and make that work. As for BMD, you know, Admiral Ruff had certainly discussed that, you know, according to the official Navy position, that is an important feature that played into the decision to truncate DDG 1000 and restart the Arleigh Burke destroyer class. It's an important feature that is going to be over the future decision-making of the future CGX, the future cruiser, which is primarily going to be, or most importantly, be a missile defense ship. But that goes to the sort of the one of the points that I made, to do the buy the kind of capability that the Navy needs for that is going to be very expensive, and that gets into sort of the question of choices and whether is that something we're going to buy, and if that's something we're going to buy in the future, we've got to be prepared to pay for it, because any way you look at it, those are $5 billion plus ships. So that's what I've got on it. I'm turning my light off.
Just a couple of comments. First of all, CNA is doing analysis on several of these issues, and so I know that they're at least enough of an issue that they've asked us to do analysis on them. Wanted to touch on the sea basing point, since I did mention the term, but I used the term very broadly. And I would like to just say I think that the term sea basing has gotten to mean so many things to so many people. I personally am pleased not to hear it. That's just my personal view. But I think that a Navy is a sea base, and it means, you know, it can mean MPF future, or it can mean carriers, or it can mean the sort of things that I was trying to talk about, which is this reconfiguring things. But when it as a term, connotes certain things, I think that starts to actually undercut the conversation of sea basing, which is an important one when you think about a naval force. And so personally, I think that the whole sea basing debate is getting some definition, which it needed for a long time, and I think perhaps that's why you're not hearing that term thrown around like we used to. Only to say that we're doing an awful lot of work on ASW at CNA, so I take that to mean that the Navy is certainly not ignoring it. Certainly there's an awful lot of ASW exercises, a lot of ASW focus, at least from our perspective.
Just an editorial comment. I was a little surprised at that, knowing Admiral Ruffhead both as a Pacific Fleet and Atlantic Fleet commanders and a CNO, it's his highest priority, and that he didn't mention this remarks here today kind of surprised me on ASW. So.
The only thing I'll add to that is I agree that it's surprising, but on the other hand, I don't worry about ASW as much today as I might have, say, 3 or 4 years ago, because I think there is a renewed Navy focus or Navy interest on that. That being said, it goes to, I'll draw it back to the shipbuilding plan once again. You know, the submarine force structure is going to go down because of the decisions we made in buying so few submarines in the 1990s. So there's a hole that in the shipbuilding plant the Navy is going to have to fill to sort of address their ASW requirements.
Okay, Mr. Meridian here, and then we'll go right there next.
I've got a somewhat more cynical question. At the height of our ASW game in the 1980s, we still weren't very good at ASW, or not as good as we thought we did, and we haven't been focused on it very long, and now people are doing studies, but ships are being built, for example, without the kind of bombing. LCS is going to have towed arrays. It doesn't even have any hull-mounted set whatsoever because the individual cost on that is too high. So in a resource-constrained environment, how are we going to address what is actually, you know, going to be in a couple of years at the time we're fielding this new Navy, going to be an even bigger problem? And do we have the resources to be able to get those fits onto these ships that are lower cost? I mean, it's a little bit of a domino effect to me. And that's for anybody, not just for the person with the
good. And I'll answer. I was a former ASW officer. I'll answer. No. The moderator's not allowed to answer questions. So anybody else want to take a crack at why Vago's wrong about the Navy's ability to find submarines?
I certainly don't want to try and answer that question. I'm really not in a position to sort of evaluate or comment on that in any sort of meaningful way. At least that wouldn't get me fired. But the question of whether we're going to have the resources to sort of devote to that, well, that, you know, goes back to the question of sort of making choices. And the Navy's going to – it seems to me that one of the things that they need coming out of the QDR process is sort of direction as to what they need to focus their resources on. Because I'm operating on the presumption they're not going to get $25 to $27 billion a year to put to their shipbuilding plan. So if they are directed on that, that, you know, high-end ASW capabilities and platforms are not as important a priority as some other things that geared towards, you know, maritime partnership or engagement activities, you know, the logical consequence of that is that, that program area is going to suffer. At the same time, the Navy is at least sort of stepping up and saying that the two things that they are very concerned about as a consequence of their decision-making in the surface warfare program is BMD and then Blue Water Open Ocean ASW. And I think that can only – that only doesn't just affect, obviously, the DDG-51 program or the restart of that, but it will – the discussion along those lines does accrue to the benefits of other programs as well, especially in light of the fact that the Virginia-class program is probably the best-run Navy shipbuilding program right now.
Just one little thing on that. When I said studies, I didn't necessarily just mean people in Washington doing paper studies. There's an awful lot of work in the fleet on operational concepts, and I think that has to be included into a solution to the ASW issues that they face. It's got to include operating, tactics development, CONOPS, and just proficiency, fleet proficiency, and there's a lot of focus on that.
Let me just ask, Byron, can you say whether or not industry is, I mean, generally speaking, if industry is investing R&D money, then they think that there is a demand signal on the end. Can you say whether or not industry, electronics, aerospace, or shipbuilding is investing in this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're clearly investing in it. Again, it's going to vary on a case-by-case basis, and I guess, you know, Vago, I'd kind of maybe widen the aperture a little bit and think about the PA program, for example, the maritime aircraft that Boeing's building as part of that ASW question. I think that's true. You know, companies like Ultra in the sonobuoy market, they continue to make investments in that area. So it's not at the forefront of everybody's, you know, first three bullet points in their discussion, but I don't see people pulling back from the market, I'll put it that way.
Okay. We'll go over here first and then back to Otto.
Dan McCarthy with Silver Eagle Consulting. And in fair disclosure, I've been out just long enough to probably not get in too much trouble by asking a question now. So, but my curiosity is, you know, we've talked a lot about what I'll characterize as kind of what ought to be talked about in QDR. We've talked somewhat about the differences, i.e. not an MCO-focused QDR. I'd be interested in your thoughts about to what extent you think this QDR will really be different, where the dialogue will indeed change. We talk, for example, about capabilities across services as opposed to within each service. What's your thought on where we're collectively headed, and is there really a strong likelihood this will be a different type of QDR?
I see there are no lights on, so I'll pick someone. Byron.
I'll key off something that Eric mentioned, which is, you know, I think the exact words was, you know, tell me how much you want to spend and I'll tell you what your strategy is. I think to the extent that, you know, we're going to run a federal budget deficit that we haven't seen since really the 1940s, maybe that ought to focus us a little bit more about what your resources are going to be in the future, and that you are going to have to make trade-offs here now. That's really going to come from on high. That has. I know we talk about, you know, we want to have a set of capabilities and a strategy, but at some point it's got to be bounded by that question about, okay, how much do you think we can afford? And back maybe to Vago's point about these trade-offs that inevitably are going to be made in this process. I think that's what's probably going to make a most effective QDR, is it would in any business or financial plan that's put forth.
Okay, we're going to go back to Otto, and then Adam will come to you.
This question is for Eric. You talked about the unaffordability of the 30-year shipbuilding plan. The question is, how valid is that plan with the decisions that Secretary Gates made? Delay of the carriers, you know, 5 years rather than four, the pushing CGX further out of the site. And if the Navy can get the LCS down to, say, roughly $400 million a copy, you know, how much closer could they get in the out years to fit up to meeting their shipbuilding, given the things that have been pushed out of sight?
Sure. Well, I think that depends on really what the rest of the plan looks like. I mean, we've seen foreshadowing for some time, and I honestly never thought it was likely to occur that we would build a CGX in 2011. So the idea that that was going to, you know, occur, be pushed out, is not a particular surprise. Do they stretch it out and sort of, you know, reduce the number of ships, overall number of ships that are being bought in the plan? If they do that, that obviously helps to close that affordability gap, but then you don't achieve your 313-ship goal on a sustaining basis. If they can get things like, obviously if they can get the average cost of ships down, whether that's LCS or something else, that helps. But getting LCS down from a $500 million ship down to a $400 million ship, it's certainly not a bad thing, but that doesn't go anywhere close to closing that $10 to $12 billion gap that you're facing there. Because, I mean, overall, this sort of in terms of the proportion of costs that LCS consumes in the 313-ship plan, while a large percentage of the ships is a small percentage of the costs, very small percentage of the costs. So I think that's sort of the way I look at that. You, if the Navy wants to buy cheaper submarines and cheaper destroyers and cheaper cruisers and cheaper carriers, that helps their affordability, but there's all kinds of new conundrums and problems that opens up in sort of achieving that set of goals, because you've got to design new ships, you've got to invest a lot of money in different ways to sort of get there. So I feel sympathy for the Navy in this one, because they're really stuck between a rock and a hard place on it, and I don't have a lot of good solutions for them in that regard. That's why I refer to my point back earlier that I don't think there is easy solutions anymore. Now we're in the realm of hard choices.
Okay, we'll go to Adam first, and then Admiral McDevitt next.
Adam Siegel, Northrop Grumman Analysis Center. We talk about the hard choices, and thinking about one of the things that's talked about in the QDR is potential for much more specialization between the services, of actually giving up capabilities. If we look at the Navy since Afghanistan, it's actually been adding quite a bit. One of my arenas, civil affairs and otherwise, the whole neck. The fact that the Navy has been bragging far more about 14,000 Navy personnel ashore than the capabilities of forces in the blue ocean. You know, there might be a reasonable question: if the khakis are ashore for years on end, why are they in khaki? And another one that wasn't mentioned is the Coast Guard. National fleet was not mentioned so far this morning, and it's one of the largest fleets in the world. What is the relationship between the Navy and the Coast Guard potentially? There are other ways to make these choices, perhaps, that are hard choices that arrive at the resources in a different way.
Well, Adam, of course, it's a good question and a difficult one. I do hear the discussion about specialization, and I think that that's something that the QDR should look at, but I also think, as my remarks said, that the naval forces and their ability to work across the spectrum is a very important part of the Navy. Your Navy Coast Guard question is intriguing and one that I think does deserve a lot more look. The Arctic came up this morning. We recently did a study that looked at Navy issues perhaps in the future in the Arctic, and our conclusion is really it's a Coast Guard set of issues. And so having an understanding of where the Coast Guard missions are really should be focused and where Navy missions are, I think could help us as we think through the Navy-Coast Guard relationship and the way that those trade-offs can be made in the future. So I think it's a good point.
Admiral McDevitt.
Hi, Mike McDevitt from CNA. Listening to Eric flay the Navy for a 313 shipbuilding plan, 313 ship building plan that is unaffordable, of course, the first reaction is no wonder the Navy's not going to submit another 30-year shipbuilding plan. But when you think about the 313 ships, it's also important to remember all the flack that the Navy got when they a few years ago when they said we really have a band of requirements that goes from 2-something to 3-something depending upon, and Congress said, no, we need a number. So they got a number. But the reality is, if you're in the world of Secretary Gates in 75% solutions or 90% solutions, 282 ships is about a 90% solution out of 313. So the question, and nobody's saying, gee, what isn't the Navy not doing today with their 282 ships? at least the Navy's not saying we can't do X, Y, or Z. There's not to say that, as Christine suggested, we aren't stretched. But the issue is, with the budget that you can foreseeably project, can we hold the line? Can the Navy tread water at 282 for the foreseeable future? Or is it in an inexorable decline down to some very small number?
I do love the way he asks questions.
Well, I'll take a first stab at that, obviously. But the first thing I would say, the 313-ship plan is a statutory requirement. So what the Navy is proposing is a direct violation of Title 10. But okay. In the first year, they're supposed to submit 30-year aircraft plans, too, I might add. So those aren't likely to be forthcoming either, from what I understand. Maybe that won't be true. But actually, in last year's plan, I didn't pick on them so much. The Navy and the CBO cost numbers came pretty close into alignment. There's only about a 10% difference that divides us anymore. The previous years, the Navy was predicting, you know, it could pay for this fleet on the cheap, and now they admit that the $25 billion in my 25 to 27, that's the Navy number. 27 is the CBO number. But to answer your question directly, it goes to composition. You can certainly have 282 or 313 ships if you buy a lot of cheap stuff. And if, depending on what you think your Navy needs to be doing over the next 30 years, that may be an appropriate choice. If you're not worried about sort of, you know, major war or major maritime competition from powerful states, and you're worried much more about sort of the periphery and the irregular warfare and things like that, then a lot of ships being in a lot of places with sort of, you know, modest capabilities may be the right solution. So I think, can we tread water on $14 billion a year? Yes, depending on what the composition of those purchases are, I think. I mean, I'd have to think you're going to run the numbers, so that's a qualified there. But my instinct tells me you buy a lot of LCSs and joint high-speed vessels that Admiral Ruff had referred to, and you cut back on your cruisers, destroyers, carriers, and submarines, sure. But if you want to maintain anything close to sort of the level of where we are today on those ships, which includes more than 48 submarines that's in the Navy's fleet requirement, then I think that's a very difficult challenge for the Navy.
Sir, right here. Mike's coming.
Dick Diamond from Raytheon. Eric sort of answered the question I was going to ask. It has to do with, you made the case early on that the Navy has done a good job of saying it needs a Navy, but not saying why the 313 or what the mix was. And we've seen that with their new cooperative strategy for a 21st century sea power. They haven't made any changes to the 313 ship fleet or mix. So I'm wondering if your predictions come true, and this is not a naval decade, the Navy top line does not go up, and we end up with a, say, 240 to 280 ship affordable Navy. Does anybody on the panel have any prognostications on how that process might work for the Navy to decide what that smaller number was and the mix?
Okay, I'll touch it. We recently completed analysis that looked at how naval forces have been employed over decades. And when you look at how naval forces, very similar forces to what exists today, were employed in the 90s, what you see is the maritime strategy. They had different labels and different names, and things changed. But you see an execution of today's maritime strategy in the 90s. And it was with a lot of very high-end forces, because a lot of what is in today's maritime strategy, and in fact today's national strategy, is deterrence. But it's also partnership building and engagement and all of those things. And all of those things were going on, as I said in my remarks, concurrently and across multiple theaters. I think that the challenge is getting back to that. And that is a challenge, given the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and the importance that the naval forces play there. And the budget constraints and the affordability, and we're not going to be building a whole lot more ships to be doing that. And that is, I think, the challenge and the choices that have to be made. And that's why I think they're not just acquisition choices, but they're also some operational choices that have to be made.
Yeah, I'll change my mind. I'll add one brief point. It's just a historical observation. And the historical observation is that if you look at sort of the composition of the fleet in 1990, you know, how much is cruisers, destroyers, and submarines, and so on, and you look at the composition of the fleet today, when the fleet came down by half, roughly half,
that composition has remained almost identical. So if, you know, to the extent that, you know, past performance is indication of future results, if we go down further, you can expect more or less the same proportion of the fleet being cruisers, destroyers, submarines, and so on that we have seen in the past. Is that the right solution? I don't know. I'm not in the business of sort of telling the Navy what the right solution is. I'm really kind of prohibited from doing that sort of thing. All I can do is sort of point out, you know, these are your options, these are the costs, these are the advantages and disadvantages, and what policymakers, be it the Navy, OSD, or the Hill, make of that is really up to them.
We have one more question in the back here, and then I think just to warn the panelists, I will give you an opportunity to answer the question that wasn't asked, if you so choose, before we complete our panel. Sir.
Dave Patterson, National Defense Business Institute. We've talked about hard choices this morning, and what I would like to offer for your consideration is the fact that you will have about $60 billion worth of reconstitution bills coming back into the base budget. And with that, I would submit to you that that is a net decrease in your overall budget, and it's not hard choices you're talking about. It's rather impossible choices.
Sounds like a statement.
Well, and
it's like Jeopardy. Be sure to phrase your statement in the form of a question.
I don't disagree with the assessment of the situation, and indeed that premise undergirds a lot of what my opening statement was about.
Let me just phrase that slightly differently also, because besides the $60 billion in reconstitution, if in fact that's the number, I know it's large, what also hasn't been talked about today is, I mean, there's really only three buckets, more or less, that DOD money goes into, and one is manpower, benefits, health care, et cetera, et cetera. The other is current operations readiness, however you define that, and the third is modernization, acquisition, procurement, whatever you want to call it. They clearly have already signaled that the best that DOD can hope for in real terms is flat. We've already seen what happens in some of the questions earlier about when you start taking additional risk in readiness. And particularly with a smaller force, every one of those ships on the maritime side needs to be ready. We already know what happens on Capitol Hill when you try to look at anything in terms of benefits, whether it's for the active force, forget about it, off the table, but even for the retired force, of which I am a proud member. So what's left is the middle bucket. And I know we've been talking around this all day, but is it any chance that the QDR will look at either of the other two buckets in terms of can we take more risk in readiness and operations, or can we take some more risk in benefits and pay for the total force? Anybody want to try that one?
Okay, let me try. Readiness and operations. I would tell you that, again, based on our work, the Navy is already accepting a tremendous amount of risk in readiness in our view. There is a fleet readiness enterprise. They have worked very hard to glean every little bit of slop out of that system, and our analysis suggests that they're close. They're going to have to completely change their operating concepts. It's no more just cutting readiness and slicing it down. On the manpower side of it and risks and benefits and so forth, all I can say there is that I hope that the QDR will take a look at that, because those costs really are driving a lot of things, and it's an important issue, but obviously a very difficult one.
Yeah, I would agree with the pay and benefits issue. I mean, it's not just the military. It's a national issue. You can see it in the automotive industry right now. It's part of the QDR, but it's probably a broader national question that needs to be addressed more forthrightly. You know, one idea is to try and move that out of the DOD budget and into a more generic category. I don't know how you do that, but... And I'll make that point. You know, if we really are at this point of impossible choices, I think, you know, the blowback you're going to see on some of this is the actual headcount impact that some of these impossible choices could have in a time period where we're already at a fairly high national level of unemployment and an era where we're seeing relatively high-paid jobs go away.
Okay. Any final thoughts before we conclude the panel? If not, I would like to thank the panel for their comments today and give them a round of applause. Thanks, CSIS, for having me. David?
I would also like to thank all of you for coming and for staying with us. Obviously, these issues are not the kind that you get to the end and say, okay, we've got that fixed, now what? I would also like to extend a final thanks to Rolls-Royce North America for underwriting these events, and I look forward to seeing you all at our next one, which is set for 15 May, 9 o'clock, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, who will refute everything you think we implied he was in favor of this morning.